Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/FTSW. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Come to Air Temple Island, your new home.
I'm the Avatar. You gotta chill with it.
You're the Avatar, and I'm an idiot.
You're a firebender. Boil it yourself.
Bolin's got some moves, huh?
I will make no such promises.
The morning is evil.
We shall meet again soon, beautiful woman.
I've been dying to ask you, what happened to Zuko's mom?
I can't wait to get started.
Yes! Finally!
Hello and welcome to From the Spirit World, a legendary Avatar The Last Airbender and The Legend of Korra podcast for DongBuFang.net. If you want extensive in-depth discussion from longtime knowledgeable fans of Avatar and longtime fandom members, then this is the podcast for you. I'm your main host, Dylan, and today I'm joined by Sam.
Hello.
Mel.
Hello.
And Jeff.
Hello.
Today we will be having a dual kind of podcast. We'll be talking about the recent release Korra soundtrack, woohoo, and also about The Search Part 2. We're going to be doing the soundtrack first, and then we'll be moving in. I'll put the time in the podcast description when we start talking about The Search, and also when we start talking about The Search spoilers. So I'll both of those for you in the podcast description. Also, I'll just audibly say when we're moving into spoilers. Email us at dylan@dongbufang.net. Follow us on Tumblr and Twitter. Dongbufang, no spaces for both of them. And this is going up the Wednesday before Comic-Con, so please be aware the Korra Comic-Con panel is at 2:15 Eastern Time on Friday, and we'll be having probably a reactions podcast going up that night. So you can look for that. Even though none of you are listening right now, because our VR listeners are down, which annoys me. But the soundtrack's out. It's a big deal. It came out today. Well, kind of yesterday. We're recording this pretty late. And I got my physical copy today, actually, along with getting the MP3 download up from Amazon.
Why did you do that?
Well, so Amazon, actually, it was cheaper to buy the physical copy, which came with an MP3 download on Amazon, than it was to just buy the MP3 download.
Yeah, that's weird.
I don't understand.
It didn't make any sense, yeah. So, I mean, I wanted the CD anyway, because it'll be cool to have, even though my computer doesn't even have a CD drive. So it's not really useful. Thank you, Sam. But yeah, it's out. Jeremy Zuckerman's composer of Korra and Avatar, awesome music, about an hour in length. It's like $8 on Amazon, I think. And then The Search Part 2 is also out now, by Jin Yang, much less awesome than Jeremy Zuckerman. Although, we'll get into it. I'm still digging The Search, I think. And that is also out, probably for pretty cheap, too.
I looked up a picture of Jin Yang the other day. He looks nothing like I thought he would.
He's like a nerdy guy. I don't know.
I remember that.
Quick Avatar news before we start talking about the thing. There's two interviews with Mike and Brian out. One of them's on IGN. The most interesting thing that they say, in my opinion, is that they'd be interested in doing something, a more adult series. And as kind of a separate thought, but still in the same answer to the question, Brian says they'd also be interested continuing in the Korra, in the Avatar universe. So, which makes me, it's like, put one and one together, and you get a more mature show in the Avatar universe.
HBO.
An Avatar show on HBO, that'd be amazing.
Blood and guts everywhere.
That is interesting, though, because they did say back when Korra first came out, I guess it was on Brian's Tumblr, he mentioned that after Korra, he planned on, like, just completely taking a break from everything Avatar.
Yeah, so they also said that after the conclusion of Avatar, and it turned out it was only like a year and a half until they started working on Korra.
So
I wonder if it's going to be possible for them to do a more adult-themed Avatar show, because doesn't Nickelodeon own that show? So I don't know what they're...
Nickelodeon completely owns the rights to everything in the Avatar universe, yeah, so...
Put it on Nick at Night.
I mean, Nick could sign off on a Korra HBO deal, and it gets royalties. Like, that happened, that's had recently something like Arrested Development going on Netflix. Fox gets royalties for that happening.
Korra can go on Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I mean, possible, yeah. It seems unlikely that Nick would sign off on something like that. Nick, whenever you talk about something a normal television network does, you can't assume that Nick would do something like that, because they're like, this is the first soundtrack probably Nick's released ever. We got recently, I don't know if that's true. We recently got the first Blu-ray in Korra ever Nick has ever released, and it's 2013, and they just released their first Blu-ray. Like, Nick is not the most in with the times network.
Times are changing.
Yeah, we had HDTV like in 2006, but apparently we don't.
I wonder how much of this is Nick and how much of this is Viacom.
That's interesting. I assume MTV and stuff like that is more ahead with this stuff. I do think Nick like has a different thought process with their shows. Like, they're like, okay, we're for kids, we don't need to do any of this stuff. But which is flawed thinking, because non-kids watch their shows, and also kids would like Blu-rays. But yeah, let's move on. Then Mike and Brian also did an interview with ASN, which is like pretty short. I don't know. They say at one point, they say, here's something and we'll talk about it at Comic-Con. So I don't feel the need to discuss that right now, because we're going to talk about it on Friday. We'll see it on Friday. There's really no need to get into what are they going to like. They're going to have a trailer. We don't need to speculate. Like, well, like at the end of this podcast, we'll talk about what we think is going to be at Comic-Con, but we don't need to read their answer and be like, oh, what's this going to be? Because we're going to see it on Friday. Jeremy did a AMA, Ask Me Anything, on Reddit today, and we will discuss some of his answers during the soundtrack discussion. And I think that's it. Oh, and something to look forward to, a reason I'm excited to talk about The Search Part 2 is because I figured it out, and I've got it also. The Dylan theory. And wait for that. I posted it on Tumblr. You'll have a link to it in the podcast description.
You stole one of those theories from somebody.
What theories?
Which one?
The first one.
So there's only one
or something.
There's only one theory.
No, the first little tick mark in there, dude.
In where?
Under the Dylan theory. Never. We'll get to it.
At the end of that thing, you say big thanks to Jeff and Mel for helping. I don't remember helping you figure that out.
You did one thing. You did. You said the Blue Spirit mask. That was your contribution.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the thematic tying. Now,
Sam, the Dylan theory on the outline refers to my Tumblr post. Below it is not part of the Dylan theory.
Never mind.
Yeah, I'll be reading a Tumblr. Okay, let's talk about the soundtrack. That's what everyone wants to hear about.
Oh, yeah, no, actually, that's my theory below there.
Yeah, I stole that from you. So yeah, we'll talk about that. So let's get into the soundtrack discussion. We're going to be playing the songs eventually while we talk about them, so quote-unquote spoilers for the soundtrack.
It's not really spoilers if you already heard them before.
I was afraid last night Dylan was going to get mad at me because I was listening to it before he was, and I was like, oh, this is where this song plays at. Oh, this is for that one. I was waiting for him to go, spoilers!
The reason I say spoilers for everything is because I'm the most sensitive person to spoilers ever, so I'm not going to like assume other people aren't. But yeah, the first thing we should know with the soundtrack is that this is a pretty big deal in terms of the fandom. One of the most, like, I would say public things about the Avatar fandom back in the early days was that there was this huge soundtrack petition that went around online.
And it didn't do anything, of course.
Yeah, it didn't do anything, but it got thousands and thousands of signatures, and petitions attract media attention, I guess. That's something Mike and Brian have talked about several times. And it's cool that we did that. And it's such awesome music, and Nick never even commented on it or anything, obviously. So now we actually get a soundtrack of music from Jeremy, and it's pretty amazing. And hopefully, Jeremy and Mike and Brian have said that if this does well, it'd be more likely for Nick to release a Avatar soundtrack, although on the AMA today, Jeremy said that it would be difficult to do because they would have to extract it from old computers and stuff, but he said he'd be more than willing to do that. So buy the soundtrack.
It's like #1 on Amazon right now, which is good news.
Yeah, it is #1 on Amazon. Definitely. So I would do this, like, don't torrent this. Last time I checked, there wasn't a torrent up, but just don't do it. Like, $8.
Listen to it on Spotify. There.
Yeah, that also gives them money. So
that's what I did.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you were complaining about their ads.
So, yeah, buy this.
Yeah.
And a note on the soundtrack. I probably told this story before. The 1,000th signature on the Avatar soundtrack petition is mine. One random night, me and Jason were competing to get the 1,000th signature. So, like, signatures 950 to 1,000 are all me and Jason. Those are like all fake names. Okay. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, right? So let's go around the horn here. what did you think of the soundtrack? Is it what you expected? Is it, I mean, the expectations are so high for an actual Avatar Korra soundtrack to release. Did it meet them? And also, what are, Mel says the soundtrack is 61 on iTunes. Pretty cool. Overall or for soundtracks?
For albums.
For albums? Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a pretty big deal. Yeah. Yeah, it's Korra's number one on Amazon for soundtracks. That's what that's. So yeah, what did you think of it overall? Did it meet your expectations? And give me a few of your favorite songs from the soundtrack, and then after that we'll go one by one through the soundtrack. Let's start with Mel.
Alright, hold on, let me get it up on my computer. But I was really, really excited when they said that they were gonna do a soundtrack, so I was like counting down the days. But yeah, I mean, it was really, really good. I'm surprised, first of all, that they included 26 songs on it, because I was expecting it to be like, you know, some tiny number, like 12 or something, just because that seems to be like what happens. But yeah, it was really good. I was surprised that a lot of the songs are actually like chopped up throughout the series and don't really, only a few of them actually play in full in the show. And a lot of them are like sort of mashups of songs that we heard during the show, but overall it was really, I love it. And did you want me to go over favorite songs?
Just pick a few.
I like Wheels a lot. I'm on A Peaceful Place. And On the Lamb is cool. Really good too.
We can start like counting when we go over song by song, but I think it's like 80% plays in full in the show, and there's a few that are spaced up. It's hard to tell. Like a game we were playing over the past day in Skype chat was try to find exactly where, well, I was playing this, try to find exactly where in the episode where the song plays. And it's kind of difficult, but you can do it for most of them. So we'll figure that out. Jeff, what do you think?
I too love it all. I'm not a big fan of the jazz element in it. Sorry. How it is. Although On the Lamb is kind of fun to listen to, but like Airtight, when you get that trombone thing coming on, it's like, oh yeah, no, I do not like jazz. We'll hear that not coming up. But my favorite has got to be Republic City Under Attack, and it's the one that was released several weeks ago, and it's still just my favorite soundtrack ever. Other good ones are A Peaceful Place. And probably Before, and also Beifong Sacrifice.
Cool. Sam?
Well, personally, I don't really care about the soundtrack being released. I just didn't get really excited about it, because I don't really care. But I listened to it. I liked it. Some of my favorite songs on it, I guess. I like On the Lamb, yeah. I like Lost My Heart in Republic City, or Left My Heart in Republic City, rather. I like Squeaky Rags. That's a fun-sounding name. I like In a Box. I like all the jazzy-sounding ones, because like, I'm actually like a fan of that 20s sort of like Cole Porter-y music. So, I like it.
Cool. I was maybe more towards Sam than Mel and Jeff. I love the music, but I wasn't like anticipating the soundtrack release too much. But I totally got into it once it was out. I love a lot of these. Some I would say are a little bit of a chore to listen to in full, but most of them are very mm-hmm. fun.
Especially
whatever. Anyway, my favorite.
Sorry, there's like one that's like, oh yeah, Before. It's like almost. It's
yeah, we'll discuss Before, but my favorite song is still. Left My Heart in Republic City. Previously Lost My Heart in Republic City.
Was it really Lost My Heart?
It was previously Lost. They changed it, I believe, to allude more to I Left My Heart in San Francisco, the Tony Bennett song, which is pretty clearly what the title is alluding to, so I'm glad they changed it. And I don't know, I just love this song. You can probably tell because I use it as the change between minicasts. Not that anyone listened to minicasts, but
I do.
None of you actually listen. Wow. Okay. No. I use it as the transition between two minicasts. Yes, and then I just play it in full in the background of the second minicast. It's really good. But that one's been out for a while. some of my other favorites, A Peaceful Place, as others have said. We'll discuss that kind of in depth. I like, which is the jazz one? Is it Airtight?
Mm-hmm.
I like Airtight. That. I'm not necessarily a jazz fan in real life, but I like the core jazz. I don't know what that means. Yeah, I'm a fan of Airtight. I'm a fan of Greatest Change at the End. It's not a terribly consistent track, but at the end it's very good. Republic City Under Attack is pretty amazing. And Wheels is very, very good. And Chi Blockers, we'll talk about this, but this plays during one of my favorite sequences in Korra, and I love the music for it. So, yeah, I mean...
One thing I'm not a fan of is how Amazon had no album art for this thing, so they put the album art in as no image available.
Ooh.
For the MP3 download of it, or...?
Yeah, well, like, MP3s can be tagged with album art.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they just have this Amazon-themed, no image available PNG that they put in all the...
That is annoying.
Amazon.
Yeah, I don't know. Amazon sold this pretty cheap for hard copy and MP3, so can't complain much about that. How does that make sense from a business perspective? Anyway, let's start to go... I mean, we all generally... All positive things to say. Go out and buy this. Let's start to go track by track through this. We are going to... There's 26 of them. Some of them we're not going to spend that much time on. We're going to say the song. Jeff's going to start playing it in the background of this. I apologize if it's too loud or too soft. I think we're good, but this is new for us. This is like high tech from the podcast. And so we're going to try to identify where it plays in the show. So I get the first one. I don't know if we even need to do this one, but the prologue is the Korra main theme for the first episode, correct?
It's the prologue, yes.
I mean, they did this with Avatar.
It's
the pilot. It's the pilot
music.
Is different than the rest. So in the first episode, prologue plays instead of Legend of Korra main title, which is the 26th track.
Such a creative name.
I know. Some of these have the worst names.
I like In a Box.
In a Box.
In a box. Anyway, so yeah, prologue plays during the prologue. Okay.
And yeah, you mentioned this is high tech from the serial. It's also like totally held together with bandwidth, like paper clips and toothpicks. So,
okay. So if it breaks, we apologize.
If everything breaks.
Anyways,
Airtight. Or the prologue. Which one? Prologue?
Prologue.
Here we go. Yeah, it's playing and we're talking over it. Anyway, not much to say on this one.
I love how pristine the female, like, choir sound is.
Please do that again. But yeah, it is very clear, the vocals in it, or the vocal, whatever they use to create
the
vocals.
Yeah, that's a better word for it.
It's hard to comment on it because we hear it all the time, but yeah.
I actually, the very first time I listened to this, once we got the soundtrack, I forgot where it came from. So it was like listening to for the first time. It's great. And now it's just old.
Awesome. Yeah. I don't know. Not too interested in that one. Let's move on to Airtight, which is the jazz thong that plays...
Thong.
There you go. It plays during the party in 104, as I discovered.
That's a nice elevator music.
Sounds more like New Orleans jazz, like Dixieland jazz, than like normal jazz, though.
I couldn't...
Some music sense for you.
I couldn't figure out where this was playing, you know, because we couldn't figure it out until literally like 10 minutes before the podcast, you figured it out. So in my notes for it, I just wrote in all caps, where did you play?
And it's a scene that's not the easiest to remember. It's at the end of 104, kind of Lin's at the party, Korra's at the party, Mako, Asami.
Big to do.
Yeah. I realized the flaw with this, Jeff, that we didn't correct was that it stops playing kind of when not you talks. I completely
Maybe
forgot that
just,
that happened.
Like, edit it, like...
No, this is like, much easier. Anyway, you can still kind of hear it.
They can just download it.
We can also just let it play for a second.
And download it, yeah.
Buy it.
Answer that. Oh, here it is.
Yeah, that is very New Orleans-y.
I argue that a lot of it is mostly, like, New Orleans-inspired
well,
jazz.
Like, the birthplace of jazz.
Yeah, and definitely then, not, like... New York jazz.
Yeah, then New York took it over.
Anyway, yeah, I don't know. I'm a big fan of this one.
Yeah, it's very sort of traditional jazz.
It's interesting where this plays in the episode. A lot of these, well, I'd say all of these are fit to the episode because they get the animation and the voices beforehand. So it's like, it's not like, oh, this is a cohesive unit. It's going to go up and down. It's going to go down when they're going to be talking a lot, or up when, I don't know, maybe the opposite. But yeah, a lot of them just like go down for a while. And it's like, why is it doing this? Doesn't make sense in the context of a song, but it's because it's playing over an episode and it was made to play during an episode. And I think this does play in full in 104. Okay. In a box.
Love it.
Is when Korra is in a box in 109, right?
Did we ever confirm that, or are we just guessing?
Allie says it, so.
I mean, that's what I said, but I didn't know if she went.
Is it that or like airbending box?
Was there an airbending box?
No. Like a box.
Let's let it play for a minute. Yeah, I'm assuming this plays during Out of the Past.
Yeah. Allie said specifically it was when she was meditating, not during the flashbacks.
I see.
So,
I just like this because they conveyed this like mournful feeling so well, looking out the window of prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this isn't one that you'd like have on your favorites list, but it's very good for the episode.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it'd be on my favorite list.
Okay, cool.
What Sam said about the Dixieland jazz style, the band that actually is also credited for those jazz songs is called the Angel City Dixieland Band, so there you go.
Ooh, see that? Look at that. I was right.
Good job, Sam. Okay, let's move on to An Impossible Crime, which apparently also plays during Out of the Past, during the flashbacks to the Akon trial, which makes sense. Yes, and it, I think it's like that throughout. Just
get to the end.
Yeah, cool. Okay, now let's stay on that. Let's move on to Being Patient / Beifong Sacrifice.
I forgot to mention Beifong Sacrifice. Beifong Sacrifice is my favorite.
You cannot blame you on that lag.
I'm assuming this is during 110 at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least the second half of it is. Yeah. It's the second most popular song, according to iTunes, on the soundtrack.
Yeah, this, along with track 23, are dual ones. I think they play close to each other. Or maybe concurrently. Yeah, let's let this play. Is this the Being Patient or Beifong Sacrifice side of it?
Being Patient.
Okay, this kind of sounds like the rally a little bit, too.
Ever since I watched Battlestar Galactica, I just fell in love with these war drums. So good.
Nice.
Let's skip ahead to Beifong Sacrifice.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's a good one.
She sacrifices her.
Something to note is that this CD doesn't have quote unquote the rally in it, which is a track that was released before, which is from 103.
But the rally that they released isn't even really what plays in the episode.
Yeah, it's weird. But you can find influences on the rally in at least two songs, and we also think Being Patient, or I think Being Patient. You can find it kind of in full at 150 into Wheels, because someone asked us on Tumblr about that, so I looked, and it's pretty much exactly there. We'll get to Wheels. Let's move on to Asami and Mako Dine, which is the worst title on the album.
So it's worse than a box?
I think so. So let's let this play for a second. Yeah, okay, that's the entire thing. It plays when Asami and Mako dine in 104.
Really?
Yeah. I figured that one out all on my own.
I'm not surprised.
Okay, On the Lamb.
Good one.
This one
starts off with a bang.
Yeah.
Hold up. Gotta give it its proper intro. Here it comes. This one just sounds like an annoying bird sometimes.
It has like a really big, like a really good like big band feel to it.
That sound right there, it reminded me of when Aang was trying to play that Sungi horn in
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so this one's pretty clearly during the first episode, when Korra's chased down.
Saw the lamb.
Yeah.
Saw the lamb.
I don't think that's a current phrase, but yeah.
What do you mean a current phrase?
Anyway, yeah.
You're saying it, aren't we?
I like this part of it. Got some good strings.
Cool. Let's do Hidden on All Sixes, which was released previously.
What are the sixes?
I think it's a bit mastered on this
on
one.
All of them.
More mastered. Okay. So it's they fixed up a little bit.
Plays in the radio. Although,
no, actually. No, this one sounds just like it. It's a different one.
I don't remember when this plays.
It's
I didn't.
Korra's music on the radio before Amon interrupts when she's.
It's the best music.
Just training in a Voice in the Night.
I see. Okay. Cool.
So I want to go out and have jazzy times.
Have a Gatsby party.
That's got to be the DF chat filter word.
What chat filter word?
The DF chat.
Yeah, what was it to what?
Jazzy times.
Jazzy times, yeah. So, okay. Anyway, good old. I like how they juxtapose these on the soundtrack. Good Old Days is next. We go from happy to the murder-suicide scene in Endgame. There's this. You'd think this would be played out more, but this track's pretty quiet and not much going on because the episode, really, the visuals are better or more prominent than the music for this.
Seems eerie and nostalgic.
Yeah, that's pretty much it the whole time. Then we have Before, which is the 7 minutes, the longest one. It plays in its entirety during the flashback sequence in Skeletons in the Closet 111. And there's not much to it. As Mike and Brian discussed in the commentary, or Jeremy in the commentary, it has an Eru and a something for representing...
flute.
No, it's a flute. Maybe a Noatak and
violin.
Oh yeah, I remember them mentioning that.
Yeah,
it was a string instrument, and then it was a wind instrument, I think.
So yeah, and it represents the Noatak and Tarlok in the flashback. And this is, I think, it should be included on here, but it doesn't do much. The track, it kind of stays quiet the whole time. I don't know. Maybe I'm too simple. For this
track. Murder's a simple.
Yeah, I think
guy.
Probably.
I appreciate simple things.
Yeah.
I like how later on in this track, they use these like really high-pitched violin strings to... They sound a lot like wolf cries. Really good.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Fresh Air is from 101 when Korra and Naga are in the South Pole. Correct.
That was that was originally released as Korra main theme back when they did release some of those tracks. But yeah, it's when she literally says we're just getting some fresh air.
Is that playing now?
Yeah, it's playing.
Okay. I guess it gets quiet.
It was boring.
Yeah. Well, no, some of the tracks dip, and it's don't really do anything for a little. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, and that's when she goes riding with Yeah, there you go.
There it is.
And they called this the Korra main theme. It's so short for the theme.
Yeah. Jeremy was kind of talking about how he deals less with character themes in this in Korra than more like specific tracks for mood and stuff.
But I like the character themes. Anyway. I like the little Katang theme.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, they had way more sort of character driven themes in Avatar.
Korra confronts Tarlok is pretty self-explanatory.
No, what happens?
It plays during when extremes meet, when Korra confronts Tarlok.
Very good.
Wow. Good job, Dylan.
I was expecting more action-y music, but I haven't gone through back and looked at that scene. I don't know if they did it just silently or what.
I think this just plays when they talk, and then when the fight happens, it's silent.
Yeah, I don't think there's any music during the fight.
I do really like this, though, even though it's very subtle and quiet.
Yeah, it's very good.
Looks like it picks up a little bit at the end.
Yeah. Okay.
It almost has a creepy vibe to it.
Well, yeah. That seems very that seems very creepy.
And a mellow, creepy vibe.
There, yeah.
A lot of crashes.
Yeah.
He just froze the computer.
Squeaky rags.
I'm a symbol crosses.
Don't remember squeaky rags, what it sounds like, so I'll wait for it to play.
In my notes, I just have more jazz music.
When does this play, Mel?
I asked myself that same question in the notes.
Oh.
I'm not sure. It might... No, that probably wasn't.
Could it be on Bolin and Kor's date?
I thought that. I think that's the best option.
Didn't we say
right
something
now?
Was during the radio?
Yeah, Hit No All Six is what plays when she's got the radio on. So this might be Kor and Bolin's
maybe
date.
Maybe.
Okay.
That's when they're training with the radio on, all three of them, maybe.
Did they do that at one point?
Yeah, they did that.
There you go.
Okay.
When they were burning faces of whoever it was.
Yeah. Well, I apologize for not knowing this one. Aman, Mel, talk about this one, because I'm confusing Aman's theme.
The very... Is it playing?
No.
Okay. Or, yeah, it is. This part. Okay, that whole beginning... part with the drums and the crashing, as Sam likes to call it, it plays at the beginning of the rally during the rally entrance, and then what follows that on this track is not what plays at the rally. So it's like they kind of spliced it up in different places. What follows this, I'm 90% sure, and I went to check, was music that plays when they have that confrontation in the statue. And then it goes into another song that plays at another point that just shows up throughout when Amon's doing things. So it's kind of a diced up song.
Talk about the that post you found about like the
Yeah, let me see if I can find it again real quick. Jeremy Zuckerman, I guess, I don't know where it came from, because when I clicked on the source, it led me to the iTunes page, but he was talking about how he used a very specific software when doing Amon's song, because he felt that Amon was, he said, was one of the greatest antagonists he's ever seen in an animated series, and he said because Amon so avoids cliches, he wanted to avoid cliches with the music. So the part that plays with the bells kind of... after the beginning, he used a software that, what I took it as, completely randomized the algorithms from in the pattern that they would play, because he was explaining it in terms of themes, because Amon was such an unpredictable character and such a non-conventional character that he wanted a non-conventional style of composing the music and non-conventional music playing. So the a lot of the music that plays through it is randomized, like it was more the computer just randomizing the music notes than him actually composing an actual melody going through. Because he said he didn't want any melodies on Amon. He didn't want any recurring theme. He just wanted music. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So I've studied a little bit of genetic algorithms. That's what he used, genetic algorithms. So really simply, he gave the computer a set of rules to follow, like, You make a theme song like this, like by playing these notes, and then he said, okay, randomize it for like it's a bass like 100 tracks off of this one parent track, and then we'll see how good each of those 100 child tracks are, and the good ones get recycled and used as new parents. And you just do that over and over again until the computer eventually comes up with Amon's soundtrack.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds like the NFL schedule. Actually, how they make the NFL schedule is they just randomize like 1,000 schedules, and then they pick one. I mean, obviously, there's a layer of recursion to it, but yeah.
Yeah, he basically wanted no simplicity to Amon's music and no melody. He was very adamant about that. He didn't want a reoccurring melody with Amon.
Very interesting. And this is definitely the most hard to pin down one in terms of where it plays.
Yeah, I did notice that
halfway through, like, there's this transition bit that sounds a lot like it was inspired by that sound. The music that plays when they board the airships in the Avatar finale. You know, when Sokka and Toph.
Yeah, no, I thought that too, I think, actually.
Which was, that was cool.
Yeah.
Music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like this song.
You like this one?
Yeah. Oh, you were trying to transition. Okay. Chi Blockers. I apologize. I was not on the game. Yeah, so Chi Blockers plays during the awesomely choreographed Chi Blocking fights in the Revelation. Yeah. And it does stuff, and then, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I really love this scene completely. I love how it's directed and storyboarded. The colors on it, right? And then this music just is another part of that. Yeah. It's pretty straightforward. It plays in its entirety during the fight, and it's pretty great. Maybe the most interesting one on the soundtrack is A Peaceful Place. And the reason is because it's like, where does this play when you first hear it? And this is the most subject of discussion when we were figuring it out. And it plays at the end of the second episode of Korra. And it's interesting because it's such a diverse piece. Like it starts playing when Korra starts airbending, or like doing the airbending form in the pro-bending arena. And it continues on all throughout the end of the episode. Yeah.
It seems to me like it's just seems like coming from like an airbender temple, like in full on, you know, airbender mode as fully populated, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really cool. And then Tenzin at some point is like, woohoo, during this, and it continues after. I don't know, I'd highly recommend this one listening to. Oh, but just so it's clear, the reason I pause and let the track play is because the track doesn't play when I talk, so I just let it go for 5 seconds for each of these. Left My Heart in Republic City. Probably know what this one sounds like by now.
This is a lot of people's favorite, and yeah, sorry, not mine.
I mean, I could see it. It's more quiet, more... It's kind of jazzy. I don't know how to describe it.
Where does this one play?
The date.
Does it play on the date?
It's not during their carriage ride. Where she's like, I feel so safe.
Not their
with
date.
You. Whose date?
Korra date. Korra and Volans.
So that's not that yeah, other song?
Yeah, we contradicted each other. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Sam. I think this is their date.
Yeah, I should have looked this up. I took this for granted and not figured out. But I guess, yeah. Which would preclude the other one from being during Korra and Volans date. I don't know, this is just very relaxing. Awesome. And I like that Republic City has a piece of music like New York, New York, San Francisco. Like, it's very with the times. Although Left My Heart in San Francisco is 50s, but whatever.
Here are the cars.
Yeah, that Brian was like, this car is from the 50s. We didn't care, though, at some point in the commentaries. Firebending Training plays when Korra's firebending training.
Yeah.
No.
In the first episode.
Strong.
This is notable because this is the first clip that we saw because it leaked. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We got this like last January. Not from Nick, from some random person.
It's almost like me and Mel and Allie were watching the first episode of Avatar the other day. And we noticed how the music was kind of different, kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like noodly, and this is kind of noodly as well.
Define noodly.
Noodly.
Like, playing a bunch of, like you ever heard of a phrase, noodling on the guitar? You're like,
yeah,
moving your fingers all freely and everything's everywhere. That's kind of like that, except this isn't a guitar, obviously. Cool. It's like a flute.
Yeah.
Which is, it's the same basic principles, anyway.
This is definitely a solid track. Definitely sets the theme for this scene very well. Wheels plays during episode When Extremes Meet, when there's the one gif of Asami popping up and like flipping her hair, and I think it starts like almost exactly after that, and like they go into Asami's car.
Sorry, I gotta say, I think it's gif.
Okay.
I will always say gif, but I didn't even realize I said that word. Yeah. And then starting at 150, like I said, the rally just plays.
Oh.
Yeah, the reason it's all thing is because they eventually get chased and stuff. And
sounds like a horror movie right there.
Yeah.
Don't go in there.
This is awesome.
This is like some Nightmare Before Christmas stuff, wow. Except not.
Except in Asia.
He's playing with the rally so much, and this one, it's great. And, I don't know, I'd highly recommend this track.
It sounds like a Halloween movie or something.
I don't know if it's... I wouldn't say that.
It sounds like this sort of, like, Halloween-y tune, like the whole... Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like that. I don't know, that just sounds like... trick-or-treating and scary
horror is the pumpkin thing.
They're yes. Driving the car going around trick-or-treating, duh.
Yeah.
They should have that episode.
They should. I want to see... Cora would trick-or-treat, though, because, like, she's, like, still a kid.
And she's probably never trick-or-treated in her life, so...
Well, no, I feel like the White Lotus, like, orchestrated this elaborate trick-or-treating thing. They faked an entire, like, put-up houses. Cora went around. Well, there's no Halloween in the Avatar universe.
I need that fix.
Well, there could be. Could be
every holiday, they had to construct elaborate things for her.
I feel like... Oh, that's so sad, but I feel like it's true.
It is.
That should be a fanfic. Oh, speaking of, Mel's working on that fanfic we mentioned last time.
Ooh, yeah, I am.
It's going to happen eventually, go up eventually.
I'm on the third chapter.
Send me the second chapter.
I will. I just like to have a buffer zone before I upload anything because I don't like the pressure of...
Upload even in terms of showing me.
Well, you...
Remind us what this is about?
This is the Boomy Theory in writing.
AU.
Yes, AU, universe where Boomy Theory happens. Amon is Boomy. Okay. Let's move on to Republic City Under Attack.
Woo!
This is great, but it's a very disparate track because a lot of stuff happens in the 4 minutes when this plays in the show. In my opinion, so let's hear the beginning. Yeah, so not much happens at the beginning. Eventually, they start fighting the mecha tanks, and then it picks up really nicely. It was kind of hard to figure out where this started within the episode, which is 110, Turning the Tides, and it happens when smoke starts to leak into the headquarters, I believe.
Switchboard room.
Yeah. There you go. But yeah, this one's awesome. And it's just very epic sequence of events. This episode's kind of nonstop action after a certain point. And this is like the main track that plays during it. cool. Hard Boiled Afraid. Mel, when does this one play?
The beginning part of it where it's kind of, I don't know if they're bells, but where it goes like, doom, like really softly plays when she's going over to the island and is saying, don't follow me and all that stuff. And then eventually it transitions into the second half, which I believe plays, or at least a portion of it plays when she's talking to Tenzin after Amon ambushes her and she wakes up.
I like it has a lot of titles.
Yeah.
Hard-boiled, afraid, parentheses, separate ways, and parentheses.
Yeah, this, what Mel's talking about is episode 104.
Oh, yeah.
Voice in the Night. It's awesome.
Jeremy said this is like one of his favorite tracks.
Well, the mood on this scene is so important in the show. I'm not 100% clear if it plays continuously. Mel says it breaks up. I assume it does, because at one point in that scene, there's no music.
Yeah, it breaks shortly after she... I think, like, when she gets on the island, and then she's, like, the waiting period is right before that is when it breaks into something else.
Okay. Next is War, which I looked... shortly before the podcast, and I couldn't find exactly when this airs, but I'm like 90% sure it's during the finale, in one of the two finale episodes.
Absolutely.
It has a surprisingly chill beginning for its title.
Yeah. I think this is maybe in the beginning of 112 Endgame, but I'm not sure. Like, I didn't play when I thought it played, which was during the ships. Like, there's not music during most of the time of the, there's bombs in the water. Like, there, yeah. Which is... I always think of Game of Thrones when I watch that scene.
Oh.
The Blackwater. Yeah. It's basically the same thing.
It is the same principle, yes.
I wonder if they'd seen that but when they were writing it. I don't think either of them read the book, so I guess.
We have to blow up the ships.
Yeah. Yeah, War, I guess, is too quiet to hear during this. Yeah, there you go. Sami and Hiroshi / Korra Airbends. The first plays during Sami and Hiroshi's fight in Endgame, and the second plays during towards the very end of Endgame, where Korra Airbends, I assume, although I didn't check to see if it plays continuously.
This one is a really interesting, like opening, like 2 seconds. Like,
yeah.
Really immediate.
It does get, there it is. It gets very emotional.
Like that.
Cool.
I feel like I'm watching The Lion King.
Yeah, I would argue that's probably the most emotional, or one of the most emotional tracks on the...
I mean, that scene's pretty rough.
Yeah. Well, both of those scenes are pretty rough.
Yeah, can we hear the Korra Airbends side now?
This is it.
Okay, cool. There we go.
She saves Mako!
Okay. That voice should be in the soundtrack.
Well, if they ask me to, I'll be happy to do it.
Okay. Yeah, that one's very good. Greatest Change plays at the very end of the show.
Fun fact, I didn't actually listen to this one.
What? This is like, come on.
I had to go do stuff. I listened to like the first 2 minutes.
Great. Well, the last 2 minutes are what you want to hear.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the most popular downloaded track on iTunes from the album, and it's probably because of the last like minute and a half.
Yeah.
Sure, the last.
Yeah, let's skip.
We will skip to now.
Yeah.
Duh, well, duh.
Now, the only time they actually used live instrumentation was for the Avatar: The Last Airbender finale, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did we get a soundtrack for that?
I think they. It's possible he used it for Korra, too.
It sounds pretty live, but I don't know.
I think he said... No, I think he says this somewhere in the anime. I'll look while we continue to talk.
This is the only time the Avatar main theme plays, actually, in the show. is right here. Because Korra's theme is kind of a version of the Avatar main theme. But, they're not the same.
Yeah. And this is Mike bring back the... Brian in the commentary says Mike always knows when to bring back the Avatar theme.
What if Katara dies to the Avatar theme?
Wow. That part that just played right there is Korra's theme, which is a different version of the main theme.
Korra has a live orchestra.
Ooh, fancy.
Brian says, I can't imagine going back at this point to using MIDI. They bring so much to the table, the live orchestra. Writing from MIDI is so limiting. With live players, I can do things that don't exist in the MIDI world. Things go beyond melody, harmony, etc.
I had to make a MIDI song once.
Ooh.
It was okay.
Let's hear it.
Okay. I made a song with GarageBand loops.
Yay. Oh, was that the song? Was that the Sam song?
Yes.
Oh, I have that song.
Yeah. Okay. They don't know what we're talking about, so let's move on. That was it, actually. No, let's do the end credits because those are important. They actually don't play when you watch Korra.
They don't.
So
I was rewatching Korra through people some memes the other week.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I heard it, and I was like, wow.
I don't think I heard this before.
Well, it played when the episode leaked. It was in its entirety, so you heard that.
I didn't watch leaks.
Yes,
wait,
sure.
No. This was also in the end credits of every episode, right?
Yes, but Nick, when it aired on Nick, they muted end credits and played something over.
Yeah.
Coming up next on Nick, Kung Fu Panda. That basically
weird, because I swear I remember this just from regular watching.
It's online. We had this on our website. Yeah. Anyway, it's really good. And then, of course, the main title is just the shortened version of the prologue.
No, Afro Circus.
Only Korra brings dogs to whatever.
Legend of Korra. Da-na-na-na-na. Yeah.
Wait, it's I have a question.
Yes.
Is it Avatar Legend of Korra, or is it just Korra?
It's the Legend of Korra.
Okay, no Avatar? Did James Cameron take that away, too?
Yeah.
Even on TV shows?
Yeah.
What?
It's not like Avatar The Last Airbender has been changed to The Last Airbender.
I know,
it's still,
but let's...
Obviously not.
It seems like they at least just don't want to go through the trouble of trying to call it Avatar.
His new Avatar movie isn't going to even be out until, 2018.
Yeah, but then the next one's coming out, the next year.
What if somebody tries to name, a thing Titanic? Well, obviously he doesn't know the
words. Don't we all watch that's out, because James Cameron will come after you.
Yeah.
Aliens.
Right, yeah, so that's us. That's us going through the tracks, yay. I wonder if that was good
Terminator.
To listen to or not. I'm actually kind of curious. Comment on the forums or tell me on Twitter whether that was good or not. I don't think it was. anyway,
it's more incentive for you to download it legally.
Yeah, you should. I mean, seriously, though, just buy it on iTunes.
$8 on Amazon. We'll get it.
Yeah, on Amazon.
Let's do it on Spotify.
Or better yet, use our referral link on DF.
Or listen to it on Spotify.
Yeah, use our... Yeah, somewhere on DF, there's a referral link, I think, on the main page. I think AdBlock might take it away, but it's there. And then Jake gets money from that, so yay.
Spotify, which is easier for me.
We actually went through pretty much Jeremy's AMA for the exciting stuff. Do you guys have any other stuff you found notable from the AMA?
I didn't read it.
Sam, good job.
Nobody told me to read it.
I linked to it on Tumblr. That means read it.
You assume we actively read the DF
yes,
Tumblr. Yes,
everyone reads the DF Tumblr.
That I want to be on this podcast, and you're like, Sam, so why didn't you read that? I'm like, you just asked
ago,
me to be
okay?
on here.
Sam, we talked about this a few days ago, and you were like,
no, we
okay. Yes, we did.
No, we didn't.
Sorry we got you in a bad mood. You're still good, though.
How many followers does the DF Tumblr have?
I forget what it's like. It's 820 right now.
Oh, I wonder if we can get up to 1,000 on Comic-Con.
830, yeah. Probably Comic-Con at all. So yeah, I forgot to say this in the beginning. On Friday, follow us on Tumblr. I'm going to live blog it. We talked about this in the last podcast. It'll be fun watching
it's
me.
It's literally always the best thing every year.
Frantic
I might not be there to see it, but...
He doesn't talk for hours at a time.
He's Dylan, like, it's not my fault.
I know, it's good. Good reasons, but yeah, anyway.
You're being a productive member of society.
Unless,
I am.
But yeah, anyway, let's move on to... Allie, okay. Let's move on to the... Well, any last comments on the soundtrack? It's great.
I'll buy it.
Now that we listen to each track, any additional favorites?
No.
You said
Sam hates all of them
in Sacrifice. That's what I was basing that off.
Oh, I did forget to leave that out of my list of favorite tracks, but that was actually one I was really pumped for too, because I liked it in the show and I saw that it was a track and I got and it was good.
Yay. Good summary.
Yep.
But I didn't feel anything when I listened to this soundtrack. It didn't make me feel.
You were definitely feeling during Beifong Sacrifice. I heard that noise.
Well, that was during this, not during my initial.
Anyway, and in the AMA, I forgot, he talks about, he says his most polished piece or something is Peace, which displays over the last 5 minutes of the show during the quote-unquote epilogue.
Peace, like a piece of pie, or like...
No, the other type.
You knew that.
It's hitting. Sam was just being cute.
Oh, thanks.
Fun fact, Sam's actually adorable.
Sam's really adorable.
Okay. Let's stop.
Sam's okay, we don't need to talk about it.
Yeah, you don't.
Peace includes the cat and kiss at the ends, which is the greatest music ever. In conclusion. Anyway, you can find that track on Jeremy's website, actually. Like jeremyzuckerman.com. /something/ I don't know. Anyway, so now we're going to talk about the Search Part 2. We will not go into spoilers yet. I will audibly... This is going to be a pain to find the mark. this is like our second recording.
No, it shouldn't be too bad.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. So we're going to start talking now, and then I'll tell you when we go into spoilers. And remember, don't not listen, because your mind's going to be blown by my theory. Cue everyone turning off the podcast. Not that anyone listens in the first place. Okay. Let's go. Hopefully Jeff is back by that, but let's go around the horn. Search Part 2. Remind us what you thought of Search Part 1. By the way, if I ever call this The Promise, I mean The Search. I'm
good. You, like everybody else, does that. And it's
the Search. You've done that like twice.
Every time I write about it, I say The Promise. Anyway.
Mel does it too.
Tell us, what did you...
Yeah.
What did you do? What did you think I was gonna make? I would make an off-topic comment. Now, what did you think of the Search Part 1? And what do you now think of the Search Part 2? And are you excited for the Search Part 3? See what I did there? I included all three of them. Mel, you're up.
I'm separating the Search Part 1 from the Search Part 2. I was okay with the Search Part 1. I mean, it's interesting. I'm not entirely happy with the weird direction it's gone, especially in the Search Part 2. I miss the days when all the fanfics were like, Zuko goes to a random Earth Kingdom town and finds Ursa, the end. Like, it just got so convoluted so fast. Got way out of hand. But the Search Part 2 did get interesting, I will say, towards the middle. I was, especially the Ursa flashbacks, and I'm not considering that a spoiler, because you knew that was... I mean, that was in the Search Part 1. So the flashbacks to, you know, the past and what happened were very interesting. Still just not overly excited with the way the plot turned out, especially towards the end. But it's interesting. It has my interest at the very least. So
cool.
Yep.
Jeff, what did you think?
Honestly, I'm like... not that invested in this arm of the canon. So, mm-hmm. I vaguely remember reading Part 1.
It happened.
Yeah.
I feel like that's actually really accurate for, I think, a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And then Search Part 2 came out, or where I'd rather was leaked, and then I read it. And, yeah, it was, I mean, it's cool. Watching them go about their days, but yeah.
Yeah, don't expect Jeff to contribute.
Jeff can take it or leave it.
Are you looking forward to the third part?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
No, because I'm a bit fascinated with this Mother of Faces thing, and it'll be interesting if your theory is true.
Yes, we'll see. He's so invested. Yes.
Yeah.
Sam, amused. I think we'll see a similar reaction with Sam.
Yeah, I was about to say, I agree with Jeff. I'm not invested in this at
all. Am I the only one who cares about what happened to Ursa?
No, yes. I don't know. I just feel the first one, I don't even remember reading. I read it, obviously. I was on that podcast.
Well, that just because you were on the podcast doesn't mean you read it.
I read it.
Actually, hundreds of people are turning off the podcast right now.
Oh, shush. Anyway, I read that. I guess it was okay. The part two, it's okay. It feels all very mediocre.
Sam's praise for part one, I guess it was okay. It's like the review for Mel's podcast.
I'll stick with it for now.
That
was for effort.
Hey, you gave it four stars. I don't really feel invested. I don't feel like I'm hooked. It doesn't make me feel.
Are you looking forward to part three? No.
Not really.
Okay.
Honestly, for me, it'd be better if they just left the whole Ursa thing alone. Just let it be a mystery. Don't touch it.
Also, the fact
it's like
that
a bee nest
that they did have Ursa planned and then cut it out tells me all this stuff is completely Jean Yang. Like none of this was.
Apparently, Mike and Brian consulted heavily.
Yeah. Okay.
Apparently,
I think their consultation was, "Can I do this?" Yes, sure.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I don't care at all what the outcome of Ursa is, and I've never cared. But I'm pretty invested in the search again now that I read it. And I don't know why, because I don't like Jean Yang's writing all that much, and I don't like this plot line. Maybe my least favorite part of the search is the Cat Eng. Like, that's crazy. It's because
he
boggles it so much that I don't care. He turns Katara into this object. It's so frustrating.
Exactly.
We'll get into that. But,
that gave Sam feelings.
Yeah, but anyway, I don't know. I'm pretty interested to see how he resolves this, even though I'm pretty sure I know what's going to happen. Because this theory is totally
correct.
You're
so, like...
I didn't read
it. Like, it makes perfect sense. That's the problem.
I don't know why I'm complaining. I can
The feeling I had when I thought of this theory is the feeling that I had when Jeff told me the Jeff theory for the first time. It's like,
the Amon-Jeff theory.
It's like, oh, that's what happened. It's like, oh, well, that makes perfect sense. That's probably going to happen.
At this point, it's spoilers because we're so sure it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it. Yeah, that's true. We're not we don't actually know it's going to happen, but anyway.
We got people on the inside.
Yeah, inside of Jean Yang.
we got like a shrink ray and we found down
his head.
That's okay. That was the more appropriate way to go with that. Okay, the search part two is I liked it not as much as part one, but I thought it was the first half, the first 40 pages, like Mel, I agree with Mel. When we actually had Ursa in the flashbacks, it was interesting. And then when Ursa flashbacks left, except for there's one small flashback in the last second half, I don't care what happens in the Forest of Forgetfulness. Like, this is so dumb. Azula Zuko fight, yada yada.
Ears off into, like, cliffs.
Yeah. Off
it picks, there's, it in, he strategically inserts one flashback to gauge your interest. But if you don't think of this theory, then you're like, you just reject the scene because it doesn't make sense. And it's like, oh, okay. And you move on and it's not interesting at all. And then, I'm going to criticize how it ends. I'm not going to say how it ends, but, I guess
everyone
we kind of
dies,
but it's, not, that's how it not all ends. Interesting cliffhanger. It's not, you don't end, you, to have a good cliffhanger, it has to be something we care about. You can't introduce a new element that we don't care anything about.
I'm literally the last page.
Yeah, like, that's, I'm sure this is a storytelling thing, Mel. Like,
it's like a commercial break. I mean, it would work as a commercial break, but not as a...
Yeah, but it's several months.
That's a very long commercial break.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get into spoilers now, so we're at 24, so don't listen if you haven't read. Honestly, though, it doesn't matter. But, like, nothing really happens in this, I would say. But if you don't...
It's not one of those great
anyway, you
second
should,
parters
I go, things. Like, I would recommend reading this. even though it's not that great. Yeah, I'm looking
up the plot summary online.
Well, no, the art is very good at times. Like, I would recommend actually reading it. But
it's no Empire Strikes Back. It's more like Attack of the Clones.
Sophomore slump.
Yeah, basically. I don't know. Okay, let's get into spoilers now. So stop listening. Okay.
Everyone stop listening.
Not everyone. Just people don't want to spoil. The first thing I want to talk about, we'll get into my theory eventually, is what continues to be... It was a very interesting plotline in the first one. However, Jean Yang just continues it and does not develop it at all. Is that Azula's Ursa visions? The question is something supernatural going on here? Is Azula just crazy? It definitely seems like Azula is just crazy from this one. Would you agree?
Agreed.
Yeah.
But
I mean, if Azula is just crazy, then what Ursa is saying would therefore have to be something. Well, it would have to be something that Azula is thinking herself.
Yeah, it doesn't make... It's more of just a device, I would say.
Yeah.
It would be interesting if he developed this, like, why is she having these Ursa visions? Like, it can't just be so simple as she's going crazy and she has mommy issues. Like, that's how they present it in the finale, but okay, Junya, you want to include this element again, great. Give us more reasoning behind it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, like, give us a psychological diagnosis, although I'd love that. Just...
I don't think he'd be qualified.
Maybe not, but give us a little bit more, is just what I'm asking. And maybe we will in part three.
Did start to say new things that she didn't say in the previous book.
Like what?
About the whole, did she talk about the whole that's not your destiny thing in the last one?
I don't know.
Something about destiny. Specifically to do with the letter.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that, I guess. I think a big problem with this middle part is that Jean Yang writes this as one thing. He knows it's going to be split into parts, but it's a one story, so the middle part's probably going to be the worst part. Because that's kind of how stories work, I guess.
Lord of the Rings.
No, the middle part's like always the best part.
Like what?
That's never true.
Like, well, not maybe not like parts. Like, you know, I personally think like the second season of Avatar is the best.
Oh, I agree with that. But Avatar,
like, second is the best middle movies though don't work.
Avatar wasn't like one story, and they broke it into three chunks. Like maybe very conceptually, but it's way more complicated than that.
It's like Lord of the Rings.
Scary
and
Movie
three
2
chunks.
Was pretty good.
Okay.
I haven't seen that many. Trilogy.
I think the second Star Wars movie, isn't that considered to be the best one? Or is it not the second, like number two, number five, I guess.
Yes.
The second Lord of the Rings movie is considered to be the weakest one.
Well, I don't care.
Just saying.
I think Star Trek DS9 is pretty good. That was like the middle one.
There we go.
So diversity.
This got really nerdy really fast for all of us.
We mentioned like the trifecta of nerdiness. Anyway, Azula fights with Zuko. I really have nothing to say about this. She firebends. Why isn't she tied up? It doesn't make sense.
He's dangling her off a cliff, too. That's
like, Azula has so much power in this situation. She's crazy and she's evil. This isn't realistic.
They want to treat her like a human being.
She's on the meds.
I understand. She's on the meds. I don't know.
I don't know. For the sake of plot, they have to kind of get along.
Yeah, it's a plot device, and it's a frustrating one.
I guess the idea is that they both want to find Ursa in equal amounts, badly enough that they're willing to put up with each other.
Yeah, so that's what it's trying to say, and I guess that's okay. And well, that's motivations. We start to get into this. Zuko's having this plot thing, which isn't very concrete. Which is he's going. I actually kind of like the direction Jean Yan's taking this. It's just not that clear that this is what he's doing, so I'm not sure if this is true. But the way I interpret it is Zuko is going back to, oh, what's my destiny? Like, he's like, okay, we'll figure out whether this letter is true or not. Whether he's actually, like, he's willing to give up being Fire Lord, seemingly, if, like, what the Azula's letter says is true. Because he just wants fate to determine what he's doing. And seemingly in the next one, we will figure out that Zuko will figure out that it doesn't matter. Fate can't determine this, just what's he can determine it. Do you agree that this is Zuko's internal stuff here?
Yeah.
So as this, I only get this though from a few panels.
Well, right? They go back to that whole remember who you are stuff.
Remember who you are.
Like, I buy that Zuko would go back to destiny and stuff, but it's a little tiring for this to happen.
Well, they talk about Azula
worries too much.
It's basically a retread of season two.
Yes.
Yeah. And Aang is like, Aang says, who cares who your dad, at one point he says, who cares who your dad is? You need to be Fire Lord so the world can be at peace. Which is like, okay, Aang's actually making sense. Because in the first, that opinion wasn't voiced in the entire Search Part 1, and it was kind of frustrating, because me and Britt kind of got into this during the Search Part 1 podcast, the whole, the nature versus, we got into like a psychological nature versus nurture debate, and no one was really voicing the nurture part of it, and now Aang kind of is, so it's good. It's less frustrating for me as a reader. Because I should say it again, my opinion on this is, I don't care whether Zuko biologically Ozai's son or not. It actually makes no difference to me. But it's interesting, I guess, to see how other characters react to that situation, I guess. That's the only investment I have in reading it. The plot development is Ozai hires a Yu Yan archer to kill IKEA / Ikem.
IKEA.
I know, he's actually Ikem. But and the Yuan archer, there's very few things that are concrete in the flashbacks. This is concrete. The Yuan archer does not kill Ikem. Like, Ikem is probably still alive, although he assumes the Forest of Forgetfulness. I don't think that's actually what it's called.
Forgetful Forest. It's Forgetful something Forest.
I don't even know if it is. Forgetful Valley. It doesn't even have forest in it. Yeah.
Okay. I had half of it.
Yeah, good job. And but. But yeah, he does. Ikem's not dead, so he's still out there. This is pretty crucial to my theory. It's still up in the air in the first half whether Ursa was lying in her letter, knowing that Ozai would find it, or whether Ozai discovers the truth.
Well, we don't. I mean, I guess it's supposed to be assumed that the letter Ozai was reading was the one Ursa wrote about Zuko being IKEA's son, but. That's still also something we were never told, is what letter actually did Ozai read when he was like, what? But I guess we're just
you're pretty sure it's that one, yeah.
Maybe he read the one she sent to her mom, like, dear mom, Ozai is a big poof face and I don't like being married to him.
What?
I miss you, mommy. Please send me cookies.
Treason.
XOXO. Ursa.
See, that's completely plausible, except later you hear them talking about Zuko. Like, they're bargaining on Zuko's life later.
P.S. Zuko is actually...
Yeah, there you go. So now it's plausible.
By the way.
Like, it could be a completely different letter that also happens to mention Zuko's not as I saw.
I don't know. It just bugged me that we never actually saw it. Especially since it ended on that note, so... Like, that was the cliffhanger of the last one.
Yeah.
So at the time, it was like, well, did he read that, or was it something else?
The problem is with this scene is if Ursa purposely wrote that letter knowing Ozai would intercept it, her reaction in this scene that we're talking about, which is around page 20 or something, makes no sense. Like, she's like, Ozai's like, I found this letter. She's like, aha, I knew you're looking at my letters. And then he's like, he mentions something that refers to Zuko not being a son. And she's like, don't be ridiculous, Ozai.
What?
Like, Ozai, please.
Like, why would you believe me? But what's the point of okay, that makes sense with the I knew you were reading my letters. Oh, don't believe what I said. But then she just lets everything play out him under the assumption that Zuko's not his son. Like if she made it up and this is going to adversely affect her child, she should correct him multiple times. But we only see this happen once in passing. She's like, oh, Zai, come on.
I don't even think she even finishes her sentence. She's just like, don't be... And then he cuts her off.
Yeah. Like, I don't understand how this makes sense.
I don't even... Like, I look at it from every motivation, like, you can have. She's lying, she's not lying. No matter what it is, it doesn't make sense.
The way I think he wrote this is he's trying to keep it ambiguous as the two things we're talking about. So even if something doesn't make logical sense from one perspective, it needs to be open, I guess.
It's way too open.
It's dumb. It's really dumb. This is maybe one of the worst parts of this. It doesn't make logical sense.
You might just be reading too much into it.
I'm pretty sure
we're asking the right questions.
I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be ambiguous. Like, it's got to be.
Isn't this whole podcast reading too much into it?
No, one of the guys on the big pool.
Well, we're not even there yet.
In very specific detail.
Oh yeah, I forgot to plug that in the beginning. Dang it. Anyway, the big pool podcast gave us this awesome 3-minute plug at the beginning of their latest one with Jeff's audio recording from
Jeff and his pal Dylan.
Jeff and his pal Dylan and a bunch of guys and gals.
We're like gals and like
what,
two
like
guys.
80%, no, 80% chance he didn't actually like turn on a podcast. Probably.
I don't know.
I don't care.
I don't know. Anyway, I appreciate the guys and gals though.
Still awesome. Yeah, Kurt's awesome. That podcast is good.
Giancarlo's anyway, check. On it's it.
Not appropriate. Yeah. Giancarlo Volpe is and his wife are current co-hosts with Kurt Mattella.
And apparently they were in the apparently they were at the panel. I did not know that.
Yeah, you didn't notice Giancarlo there?
I didn't even notice.
He's just this Italian dude with a goatee.
Yeah.
He just like, looks like Giancarlo.
I was a bit preoccupied being in the front row.
I mean, you could have no, okay, that's not a good thing to say. Enough. Okay. Anyway, I was about to say something stereotyping, but I'm not going to. let's get into the Dylan
theory. I am Italian, so I can say anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Dylan theory.
The Dylan theory. So, I randomly thought of this at the end. I searched Tumblr for Noriko, who is this random woman in here, and I didn't find anything about the search, so I think no one's came up with this theory before. Which means I'm the smartest person in the fandom.
Someone came up with a similar theory that could be tied in, like a theory that could tie into this easily. Like the extension of their theory, if they had thought about it more, would be this.
Okay, let's.
Why do you name series after yourself?
Tell me, because I'm awesome and I came up with it. So. I mean,
so literally,
I
he was reading, and then all of a sudden he was like, "Wait."
Wait, yeah. It's like, wait,
I have a theory that I'm going to name after myself.
Well, I named the Jeff Theory.
And then so. The more he talked about it, like, the higher the percentages went of how certain he was.
Well,
true.
I mean, I did compile, like, there's a lot of evidence for this. Okay, let's get into
I
it.
Don't know
so here's the theory. I linked to it in the podcast description. It's a very long Tumblr post about this, but it's worth it. We're also just going to discuss it, so you don't need to read it. But, so, there's Noriko and Noren. In
nice
the search,
alliteration.
Yeah,
almost sounds a little
almost
too
sounds
good.
Made up. Yeah, exactly.
And who are they?
Anyway, so the theory is that Noriko, this woman, is Ursa, and that Noren, and so that's the fundamental thing. And also, I also think that Noren is Ikem, who's her husband.
That's not vital to the theory, though.
It falls apart if that's not true, but it can all that the Noriko being Ursa part can be true without the other part being true.
Yeah.
Yes, Jeff?
Who's Noriko?
The one.
Exactly. So so Noren goes up to them at the play, at the dragon's play, and he's like, "Oh, I'm the troop guy," and he brings them home, and Noriko is his wife, and you see their daughter, and they talk about Ursa at their home. It's only for a few pages. That's probably the biggest thing you can say why this theory is fishy is why would they only show Ursa for like 2 pages? It also kind of makes sense though. Like,
I don't think that's the big thing that's fishy with this theory.
Well, I don't think anything contradicts this theory.
I can think of a couple
few
questions.
Big questions. Yeah, there's a few big questions that we need to answer. But anyway, so we'll go over the evidence later, but I'm going to read no, Sam, that got contradicted by this. Okay.
Good.
My first reaction to seeing Zuko interact, this is one of the tenants. Zuko, there's this little girl, Ki. First of all, I thought she was 10, but if this
she's
theory
five.
Works, she has to be 5.
Or you're slightly older.
She could be. She's playing with dolls. It's not
clear. I mean, premarital children seems to be a theme of theirs, so.
That's true. I mean, she could be 5 and be premarital, too. But anyway, so I saw this interaction between Zuko and Ki. And Mel agreed with me. There's something more to those two than just randomly meeting each other. Especially because
randomly being paternal or brotherly or whatever you want to
brotherly
call it.
Brotherly or, yeah. And they interact and Key's like, you better please come see me again or something. And Zuko's like, we'll see or I'll try or something at the end. Anyway, so my initial reaction to seeing this was to ship it.
Oh my god.
much like Bolin and Jinora, it's a ship that happens in the future. It's not
math.
You
did the math.
I did the math, and it worked for Ki being Zuko's wife, eventually.
Right, can we just stop?
Look, earlier, or before that, he was telling me there was canon Zeus-est.
That, okay.
Zeus-est, which there wasn't.
The reason that it looks like there's canon Zeus-est is because there's two scenes they show from, what's the play name?
The Love Amongst the Dragons.
Love Amongst the Dragons. The first one is a fight scene, and then we see Zuko and Azula being like, oh, we reenacted this play. And then there's a love scene. So
specifically that fight scene is what they had to reenact.
I took it that they were reenacting the love scene.
Okay, let's move on.
It's pretty clearly the fight scene. Upon further reflection, there's two characters that are blue, and I thought they were the same character, but they're not. Okay, in the play. Anyway, the shipping math worked out, by the way. It was legit. But now I don't think so. So here's the theory. I'm going to read it from this long paragraph. So this is in chronological order. And we'll get into the evidence after. So here's how it goes. Ikem goes into the Forgetful Valley, probably knowing that he's hunted by Ozai and the UN archers. He meets this Mother of Faces spirit, and he gets his face changed in order to avoid persecution. And he gives a new identity. He names himself Norin. Ursa is banished and goes back to Hira, where she's from, to find her parents, and also probably Ikem. Apparently her parents are gone, and that seems kind of suspicious, but that's not important to this theory. She meets Norin, which doesn't make any sense. So this is the main suspicion with this theory. Why is she meeting this random person at the end of this flashback? And also, this contradicts something Norin said earlier, which was that no one's seen Ursa come back to the village after Ozai took her away. So obviously something's up here. But other than that, there's not... That's really the only thing that's like glaring at you. Something's going to happen with this. The rest of this is based on mostly circumstantial evidence. So
he's a pimple bicep.
He's a what?
A pimple on my bicep.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She's so interested in all
anyway,
of this.
Yeah, this theory doesn't interest Sam. So the flash. This is the key to this theory is pages 60 and 61 of the search part 2. The first, they don't recognize each other. Then at the bottom of page 60, Norin has this face. And it's not clear what emotion that face represents. But I'm saying it's a face of recognition. And he realizes that this is Ursa. Because Ursa looks like Ursa at this point. He doesn't immediately tell Ursa, because if he was like, I'm Ikem, she'd be like, what are you on? You don't look like him. So
he's also dead as far as she knows at this point.
Yeah, so he's also... So, like, there's multiple reasons not to tell her at that point. But he says, Ursa's like, I'm here with old memories, sad. He says, old memories don't always have to be unpleasant. Like, this is a big evidence for it.
And he invites her to breakfast.
And then there's this type of love connection afterwards. He offers to buy her breakfast and then I expand that. He intends to tell her his true identity. And then he takes her to Forgetful Valley. Here's where the theory a little bit falls apart, but it's not something wrong. It's just something that it's why is this happening? Why does Ursa need to change her face? It's not clear. Like, she's banished, but she should be safe in Kira.
Maybe she's afraid of Ozai.
Yeah, so probably she's afraid that Ozai's gonna... Because, like, only she knows that they poisoned Azula, and so maybe she thinks Ozai will come after her again. So she changes her face with the Mother of Faces, establishes the new identity of Noriko, and marries Norin and has Ki.
Which explains,
so this explains the connection between Zuko and Ki, their siblings. Flash forward to the present, Ikem spots Zuko and everyone at the play. And there's also this thing where a couple who they're talking to says, oh, I heard this theory that Ursa, and then he cuts them off. So there's further
evidence. With a blue spirit mask.
Yeah, he's wearing a blue spirit mask before this, which doesn't really make plot sense, but Jeff pointed out that it makes thematic sense. He brings them back to his house. Why does he do this? This is another question. Maybe so Ursa can see her children. That makes sense. And here's another big flaw with this theory. Why are they lying to everyone, the gang plus Zuko plus Azula, about their identities? Because
why doesn't Aang be smart and like wear an actual disguise?
Yeah,
the headband.
Yeah. Yeah, is Aang just wearing a headband the whole
time? Yeah, he's literally just wearing a headband.
Wow, good job, Aang. They lampshade that in the beginning, but
Katara
then
Katara brings it up. She's it doesn't work when you don't have hair, but
apparently that's not important. Anyway, so
I thought of a little bit of an addendum to that theory.
Okay.
When Norum is making that love connection with Ursa, I think it makes a bit more sense for him to not tell her who he is right away. Get to know her and then say, hey, I know where your husband is. Let's go to Forget the Lie and find him. And then they go. And then he reveals there, hey, I'm actually him.
Boom, he's already here.
Here's the spirit lady.
I see. Yeah, that probably works too. And then maybe she can see some evidence at the face spirit too.
Kind of going off what Jeff said, someone suggested on Tumblr, I don't know, I forget who it was, that the mother faces like trade you faces.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, so the idea is that Ursa and Ikem's IKEA, freaking whatever his name is, their face would still be there. It still exists. It belongs to, you know, the mother faces, but they're wearing someone else's face. The idea is, A, that now you have proof for the gang and Ursa. Like, if, as Jeff said, you went into the forest and was like, okay, it's creepy, there's my face. But also at the end, they could get their faces back now that Ozai's not trying to kill anyone.
Yeah, I think that's... My theory is a little bit predicated on the... It doesn't just take a face, it trades a face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not completely, but...
I really want there to be a co-connection.
Yeah, there's got to be a co-connection there.
The mother of...
Yeah, maybe this is Co's significant other, yeah.
Yeah. So,
Everyone has relationship problems.
Or maybe she's like his mom or something.
The mother face.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, well, their faces.
I mean, their romance would never get old. They can just change faces whenever.
Boom.
Yeah. Spice up the relationship. Anyway. So here's the paragraph I write on here. Here's what would happen in part 3 with the extension of this theory. It's like, oh, surprise at the end. These people you met before are actually Ursa and Ikem. There's a reunion. There's the confession, the optional confession that Ikem is actually Zuko's dad. But the theory still works if Ozai is actually Zuko's dad, or as Mel suggested, the theory still works if Ursa herself doesn't know, like you have a hooking up twice recently part thing, and Ursa doesn't know, and Zuko's like, oh, I don't care, like I'm Zuko. So that would be great to finish his plot development, and then Zuko meets Ki again, and they're sisters, and maybe Ki can come back in Korra now and is older, and. And, yeah, and then either Ursa and Ikem continue to be undercover, or they go get their faces back, and Ursa comes back with Zuko to the Fire Nation.
Yay!
Boshiroi in the Fire Nation.
I think that probably not all of this is correct, but I think at this point, I'm like 90% sure most of it's correct.
We're on the right track.
Why does everything have to be so confusing all the time?
Like I said, I miss the days when it was just Ursa's in some Earth Kingdom town, let's go get her and go back.
Yeah.
So let's go over the evidence real quick. There's 8 pieces of evidence that we found.
That you found.
That I found. Oh, Mel helped me with this a lot. The first one is that Sam was not helpful.
Sam
the first,
was laughing at us.
Yeah. The best evidence is something is up with Norin because he lies to them. Like, it's pretty blatantly inserted.
Norin always lies.
Yeah, why is he meeting Ursa in the flashback?
Why
the gang?
Why is that what they're showing, in the flashback?
And then saying, no, I never met her after she ran off to the capital.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that something's up.
Did he, like, explicitly recognize her as Ursa? Like, and say so in
no,
the promise?
No.
So it's like technically possible he never actually recognized her, and so he didn't know
it's possible, but they went to breakfast.
Yeah, so.
And he knew her before.
There's that, like I said, there's that one panel on page 60 where he makes a face, and something's up with that face.
Yeah.
But he doesn't say, oh, you're Ursa. No, he doesn't say that. There's the romantic connection at the bottom of page 61. Which could alternately just be explained by Norin's like, oh, here's this beautiful woman. Like, it doesn't need to be for this theory. Like I said, evidence number one is concrete. Evidence number, the rest are just circumstantial. Although number one's also nuts. is also circumstantial.
It's the less circumstantial.
Yeah, less circumstantial. Noren looks shocked to see Ursa, the face they've made. But if they've never met before, why is he shocked? He also could just recognize her as being a big deal. That's an alternate
thing.
She's a big deal. Old memories don't always have to be unpleasant. I think this is one of the best evidence lines. It
could be just a pickup line.
It could be just a pickup line, but this line makes perfect sense according to my theory, under my theory. Number five, as Jeff pointed out, the Zorn's wearing this blue spirit mask, which thematically connects him to Zuko.
Speaking, it is not the exact same mask, but it's the blue spirit mask.
It's like, why is he wearing this mask?
Yeah.
Like, when I saw it, I was like, when you see it, you're like, oh, and then they never talk about it again. That's another thing that hangs, like, going into part three. And he also cuts off the couple saying a rumor about Ursa, which would make sense if they're trying to hide their identity. Ki has a connection to Zuko, which isn't concrete, but we think that she's more significant than it seems. Me and Mel.
I thought that though before even like even when I read it the first time before even you know last week when it came out that I was like they're really. I was just taking notice, like, wow, he's really, is this supposed to show that he'd be, like, a good dad or something? Like, I noticed that it was, they were really connected, those two.
I thought Zuko was just good with kids.
Sam, there's only two options here. Either you ship it or they're brother sister.
No third option.
There's no
I third do option. Like, though, when they're sitting there talking and he's like, oh, do you want to see my dolls? And Zuko's like, yes, of course. And Zuko was like, no.
Maybe because Zula was kind of a crappy younger sibling.
That's my point.
Yeah.
No.
I really like their interactions. Like, I thought Jin Yang was that well. Yay, positive things. Noren.
At least she didn't set it on fire.
What?
At least she didn't set the doll on fire.
I liked that line, too.
Yeah.
It was like, I wanted to set it on fire, but for you, Zuzu, I resisted. You're welcome.
Evidence number seven. Noriko says that she met Noren 5 years ago. Ki could be five. It all works with the timeline of Nora's versus banishment, which Mel kind of calculated. It works. Don't question it. Years are hard to figure out in Avatar. Like, it never specifically said when Ursa's banished.
I put Zuko, her banishment around Zuko being 8 or 9, so...
Yeah, like, I think Mike and Brian probably said when that was at some point, but I don't remember. You could go by Avatar Wikia's fake years, but those are made up and dumb. So let's not do that.
You're made up and dumb.
Well, they're not fake years. They just base their year off the war.
Yeah, but that's not how it works.
Just like Star Wars.
I mean, it works in terms of the show, like anything else.
If you want to fake keeping track of things, that's fine. Yeah. But that's not established any canon in the show at all. The inclusion of the mother faces. This is another big one. The mother faces has to be about Ursa. Like the spirit is introduced in a comic about finding Ursa. The mother faces obviously takes Ursa's face. That could happen under another theory, but that's gotta.
Well, whether she's the wife or not, she doesn't have her face. Basically.
Yeah, it's like the inclusion of this means she's hidden. Not from a logical perspective, but from a storytelling perspective. Like, there's no reason to include that unless that's what happens. So, yeah, that's the evidence. Let's talk about some of the things that don't work with this theory. I've got three here, and Mel, add if you have, although I stole one from you, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, Sam.
Pay you attention. Don't have to, like, say
the podcast.
Like, I didn't read that out loud.
Okay, so there's, yeah, not that one. There's three things that are fishy. One, like we mentioned, why is... That wasn't on purpose. Why is... I think I made the connection there. Why is... no, not right. Why is Ursa hiding from her children? And why did Noren invite them back to see Ursa? The second one can be explained with, oh, Ursa just wants to see them. But why are they hiding, even though it's safe and everything?
I mean,
think that needs to be explained.
I don't agree or disagree with those questions. Actually, I do. Well, I'm just throwing out devil's advocate here. Like, one option is, you know, Zuko never says who he is. Those two never show recognition. You could make the argument that they don't know who he is. Noren... especially no matter who he is, wouldn't recognize him. But I do think Ursa would recognize just older versions of her kids. But
he has a big old scar on his face.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing. I mean, I could see her not recognizing Zuko because of the scar, but I mean, Azula looks pretty much just like a bigger version of tiny Azula.
I think also Norrin, not even knowing Ursa them as Ursa's children, might know Zuko just by his scar. Like, I think I could see a moment where this is explained in the part three where it's like, oh, you guys weren't hiding yourselves very well. Like, and that would also explain just the headband comment. And it'd be like, ha ha ha, I guess that we weren't. So that's how he knew. All of these things, there needs to be something in part three to explain them. And I think that's true of why is Ursa hiding. Number two, why does Ursa get her face changed pretty much?
Which she basically has to do, no matter if your theory's true or false, like you said.
Like, yeah, so Ursa's going to get her face changed in part three, like, almost, from a storytelling perspective, almost positively. Why would she be peer pressured in part
three? Like, he is, like, hey, it's all babe, the I changed my face. Come on, let's go change out your face too, dude.
Exactly. But yeah, this one, I think, can be answered in one line in part three, Ursa being, I didn't feel safe from Ozai.
Or Ozai could literally actually send, like, things after her.
That could also happen.
Because so, he seemed to... Did he tell... He told Zuko... In the beginning of the... Not the promise. The search. They talked. Did he say that she went back to her village? To Zuko? I think that's where Zuko got it from. So he knew where she went.
Does who say the what?
Ozai. I used a lot of pronouns. Sorry. Ozai, yeah. I think, says to Zuko, she went back to... Here.
Do we see him saying that? I don't remember.
He says something to Zuko that leads Zuko back to that village.
I guess. Maybe. I don't remember.
So, Ozai might know where she is.
Yeah. Well, Ozai would logically assume she went back there.
What is the point of banishment if she went she's still in the Fire Nation?
Send her somewhere else.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think of that.
Banish her to, like, one of the air temples because there's nothing there.
With Patsyk.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that needs to resolve. I can think of reasons, but that...
Oh, that's a good fan fiction. Ursa and Patik.
Spoiler, she was hanging with him the whole time.
Yeah. Plot twist.
Plot twist. Younger Patik, yeah.
Not that much younger.
No, not that. But okay, so... And I think this is the biggest thing wrong with the theory, what I'm about to say. And this doesn't... It's not from a perspective of, oh, this contradicts the theory, because it doesn't and it's easily explainable, but just all of this is predicated on Jean Yang hiding and weaving this information into part two, and he's setting up for this big oh moment. And this page 34 most doesn't make sense with that, because it's all very much in the current moment and not filled with latent things that could maybe be explained later.
What
that
is
makes
happening
sense.
On page 34?
It's just Ursa. It's just not Ursa. It's Noriko might be Ursa, and Norrin discussing, like, with the rest of the gang, like, sitting down.
Okay.
They're like, oh, and Noriko's like, oh, I heard that Ursa, and Norrin's like, no, that's not true. Nothing ever saw of her. And then at the end, they're like, what probably happened was she went into the Forgetful Valley. And, how romantic that happened. And then the other one, who didn't say that, is like, romantic or tragic, that place is dangerous. So the way you explain this in the theory is that they're just putting on an act.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
yeah,
just...
Well, that's, I mean, that's part of the thing that I think might work for the theory, because, like, some of the information, they were like, when he was asking about Ikem, it's like, oh, I think it was her boyfriend. It was like, no, then this, it seemed like it could work. Like, I see where it seems like it could contradict, but it also seems like it works in that sense, too.
Like, it can be explained, but I don't get the feeling, I guess, is what, from that this is Jean Yang hiding information here. That being said, he can't just be giving us these 8 clues like he does of, like, our evidence the entire time. He needs to actually have things that make sense currently in the part two. So I guess that's what this could
be. Which nothing does, because new things are added that also don't make sense.
Yeah, there's stuff that doesn't really work. But I still think, now that I thought of this, I can't really not think of it, and I think this is what's true. Mel, what do you think?
I mean, even if I don't 100% agree, I do think this is the right track. I mean, the fact that Norrin met Ursa way back when she first showed up and then just happened to meet the gang, and then claimed he had never met her. He didn't see her since she left to go to the Fire Nation. And I thought it was also weird that these people, or at least Norrin, claimed that, like, oh, we heard a rumor she got taken off to the capital. When I'm pretty sure, you know, everyone saw him, you know, IKEA challenge. I keep calling him, I can't not call him IKEA now. challenged Ozai in the middle of the street. Like, I think it was a big to-do that everyone knew happened. And the fact that it was kind of being standoffish with information about Ursa. I mean, I mostly agree with you.
So. Okay. Jeff, do you buy it?
I think you're on the right track. Yeah. I agree with Mel.
Okay. Sam, do you not care?
I think your theory makes sense. I wouldn't be surprised if it happened. I'll say that.
Okay. So, the next step, you get caught up in, like, oh, we're figuring out what happened. From a critical's perspective, you have to say, if this turns out to be true, is this Jin Yang doing good? Jin Yang do good?
I don't think it is.
Why not, Sam?
It just feels really stupid.
Why?
It feels. It makes me feel like...
You get feels from this?
Not good ones. If, like, we're talking about your theory, if your theory does turn out to be true, and if it is Jin Yang, like, I don't think it's good writing, to be honest.
Why?
Be like, hey, kids, we tricked you back at the house. We're actually... IKEA and Ursa, ha ha ha, we fooled you. We made you go out into the swamp thing.
We tricked you into the swamp thing. Well, what it is called Forgetful Valley. Maybe they forgot Forgetful who Valley. They were.
Yeah, so that's Maybe. Something that's something hmm. I thought of but didn't include in the evidence. Why is it called?
I don't know. It just seems so convoluted and so, like, pointless. I like the small little Find Ursa in Earth Kingdom towns.
Yeah, so here's my opinion on this. From a perspective, when you look at this plotline with Avatar, it seems so minute and dumb because you introduce characters within the comic and those characters turn out to be important and it's a twist, but only within the context of the comic. Like, it's possible there's another layer to this that ties back to Avatar, like maybe something involving the herbalist, like which we'll get to in a minute, but
the herbalist,
but it doesn't make, it's not satisfying from an Avatar perspective. From a storytelling perspective, just isolated within the search, I think this would be Jin Yang's best work yet by far. Like, I think this would be very, if he does what I think he's going to do, it's going to be very well executed. It works great in terms of dividing it into multiple parts. Like
it's like a fanfic.
It's like a well-done fanfic. You lay the foundations.
It's like a complete fanfic.
Yeah. I think it would be well done. Then you give the clues and you tuck it in there.
I think it'd be rare.
You think it'd be what?
Rare.
What do you mean rare?
Yeah, of all the Ursa stories.
No, you said well done, and I said
oh,
rare.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, but
meat.
I forgot what I was going to say.
You liked the tucking it in and the layering.
I think it would be very like. There's so.
You
often,
said tuck it in.
So often in shows, you see. Or stories, you see a big revelation at the end that you could have found evidence for throughout, much like who Aman is. So what happened in Korra, I think, was a bad example of how you execute that, because they didn't start giving us clues until episode 9, and then when they did give us clues on who it actually could be, they pretty much gave it away, kind of. Not that it was obvious, because they threw other stuff that didn't make sense in there, but you could figure it out just from episode 9 and no other episodes throughout the show. However... or episode 8, maybe. I forget which one it was. It's kind of both. So I guess two episodes. However, with this, it would be well weaved into the entire part 2. In addition, it's not weaved into part 1 so much. I guess I could go back and read with this in mind now. But that had to establish Ikem's character and all these plot developments first. It would be a good example of how to execute this. Yes. I would say. And seeing as how I don't really care about the Ursa storyline in terms of Avatar as a whole, I would very much welcome this ending happening.
Too much stuff happening.
Yes. So it's possible none of this happens. So let's talk more stuff now going
She's
away
actually
from
the Earth Kingdom town.
She's just in there in a house. It's like, oh, we didn't check this house. How dumb of us. Jeff, talk about the herbalist thing.
Yeah, it's a really tenuous theory, but it's kind of cool. I'm going to give you some poison to kill Azulon with, and he says, where did you ever learn to make poison like that? And she says, my mother was a master herbalist. And immediately I'm like, oh, we know a master herbalist.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's her. She looks to be at the right age.
That's gotta be hinting at that.
Otherwise,
it could just be a throwaway, but like, it's like, oh, you can make that connection.
She randomly knows how to make deadly poison.
Yeah. So first of all, even if we did see that they had flowers and stuff, and you can in the part one, and oh, okay, her mom's a herbalist. Even if that's true, it's still like, oh, Ursa's the only one in the world who knows how to make this poison. You need to go along with her because this. It doesn't make sense. It's like, oh, that's very convenient.
And they're used to the phrase herbalist too. I mean, there's other things.
Yeah. Do you think there's any significance beyond just the reference to this, Jeff?
Nope.
Okay. Nope. Like, I could see them
Ursa
going.
Ursa is kind of like Katniss, in a way.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Why?
Ooh.
I
don't know.
Okay.
Because, like, I don't know. IKEA
Katniss
would be
name
like.
Is a flower, and.
Oh, sure.
Ursa's a bear.
Ursa's a bear.
No, because I...
That's it, Dylan. That's why her and Azula need to go on their Brave-style bear field trip.
That's true.
She's already a bear.
That's very true, though. Mel was rewatching Brave and said that Azula and Ursa. Yeah, what she said. Okay. Anyway, herbalist. The brother and sister from the Northern Water Tribe that they meet.
What?
That was like a fanfic. That was like a fanfic within this almost fanfic.
That's something that it's like, oh, there's probably more to this, but then you think about it and it's like, I can't think of anything that there'd be more to this.
When you were talking about like the IKEA and Ursa being those two people, I thought you were talking about these people.
No.
That's what I thought.
These people don't matter and they're dumb.
Why are they there?
I think they're just the people to be the people who know in this.
To advance the plot of this.
That's dumb.
It's possible that there's more. Maybe I'm overlooking it, but I don't think so. Let's talk about the flaws in Katara's character. So we've talked about sexist Jean Yang before, and it's like almost a meme now. It's like feminist Golan, but sexist Jean Yang. And I don't think if you look at the Search Part 2 on its own that you get the impression that there's any sort of sexism. However, if you look in the context of Jean Yang's body of work, you see that 80% of the time we see Katara, she's talking about marrying Aang, or, oh, I love Aang, or it'd be great to get married someday. Which I love, and I want to see that, but it takes catting from my favorite thing to just this horrible, awful thing within this.
Because Katara isn't a character, she's
Aang's girlfriend.
So I think this is a consequence of the comic format. You can't focus on every character as much, it's shorter, but if you're not going to focus on a character, you can't make Katara's only attribute this. Because
well,
it
maybe
comes
it's not so
very
much
badly.
Comic format, it's just like the short-form comic format. Like
the
this
short-form
is like a,
comic, yeah.
This is like a graphic novel, not
it's only
really.
80 pages, and like five of these pages were Aang chasing after a bat. So,
yeah.
Which is actually accurate. So,
but like if we look at like comic series, like, I don't know, Nightwing, for example, because I read that. Yeah, like you see, like Barbara Gordon is Nightwing's girlfriend. For a while there, and like she has character. She's not just Nightwing's girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I wasn't trying to stereotype comics in general. I do mean the short. So to be fair, though, there is one scene where Katara waterbends the waterbending people who are throwing flowers.
Yeah. Doesn't she waterbend the plants?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
good
it's
job.
Like, oh, Katara waterbended. So she has two attributes in this thing. She waterbends and she wants to marry Aang.
80%.
That's what she's always wanted to do. No, just kidding.
Yeah. It should be noted that Aang is, what, 14 in this?
They put him at 14 or 15.
He's 14. I think he's 14, yeah.
Outline, it says Katara. 80% excited about marrying Aang, 20% waterbending.
I mean, that scene by itself, if you don't take it in the context of Jean Yang constantly doing this, it is actually a pretty good scene where the old lady is like, oh, you two aren't two, or something about those two getting married, and Aang's like, panic mode, and Katara's like, yes, that.
Yeah, it's very Stop cute, and I like it. I like he's developing the relationship, but it's sexist. Like, I hate that. But he's doing a decent job with the cute, but also he's not giving more depth to their relationship, kind of because he hates it, probably. He's like all Zutara. Where did you find Zutara in this
one? Oh, it was that dragon guy and the water spirit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that. Okay, so one thing I really didn't like that Jin Yang did is there's two instances where he takes something that was referenced within the show, and it's like, cool, you're going to expand these minor things that are within the show, but he does it in a very dumb way. The first one is Zuko in either 119 of Avatar or 120, the season one finale, is like, Ozai said, what was the line?
Your sister was born lucky, you were lucky to be born.
And it's like, oh, he's paraphrasing his father's attitude towards him throughout his childhood.
Nope.
No, Ozai says that line exactly.
And oh my god, that's so dumb. Like,
like, it's cool that you're expanding something that happened in the show, but that's not the way to do it.
It was a weird context, too, because it was like, Zuko was born, they weren't sure if he was a firebender, and he was just gonna, like, throw him out of the palace out on the street, and he says to him, you were lucky to be born. Like, how does that, that's like a complete non sequitur. How do those two, come on, Ozai. Like, yeah. It was like that line was literally, like, shoved in there.
Yeah, he wanted to include it, pretty obviously. That wasn't done that well. I appreciate the sentiment, but no. And the second one is showing the Love Amongst the Dragons play, which was referenced in...
No.
Was it just referenced once in Ember Island Pilots?
Yeah.
Or was it referenced again somewhere in the show?
I think it's just the Ember Island.
Okay, so it's cool. You're going to show the play that was referenced in the show. Oh, it's this dumb Zutara play. And we see stereotypes. It's like... This one isn't as bad as the previous one, but it's still a little bit annoying.
Like, it was nice, like, in the Search Part 1, where they, you know, made reference to Ursa, like, auditioning and stuff for Love Amongst the Dragons, but not
that's actually. Another thing about helping your theory, Dylan, is that she was an actress.
Yeah, so she, yeah, so she's good at pretending in this, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen similar things done before in this vein, like, have you heard of Halo Legends, anyone? It's like an anime version of Halo, only like seven of them. And they're just like short stories, and they're all different styles of anime. It's really cool. And the last one is like awesome, totally cool. Then like at the very end, Master Chief meets up with Cortana, and she just starts spouting off all these lines that Cortana made in the game, like trying to shove them into regular conversation. Like, ooh, we're going to make the gamers all happy. Very dumb.
Yeah. Yeah, I think... Jin Yang at least tries to make them within, like, story. I don't know, I don't think he succeeds very well.
Not very well.
The second thing he does is that he takes scenes that we saw in the show, and then he just puts them in the comic. So we see Ursa saying goodbye to Zuko, and it's the exact same thing that happens in Zuko Alone. So I guess the question is this necessary?
No, but it was nice
you can
that
do
he...
it artfully.
What was that, Jeff?
I said, like, there's artful ways to do this that aren't in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, I'd agree with that. It's the exact same shot as in the episode.
It was nice, though, to see that she said goodbye to Azula, too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that wasn't shown. And
yeah, I agree.
Yeah, the stuff in the flashbacks that wasn't directly from the show is great, like expanding that Zuko Alone a little bit. However, also, the way he expanded Zuko Alone was just the exact way it seemed like he would expand it. Not the Ursa saying goodbye to Azula, but the whole, the backstage stuff with Zuko and Ozai, Ozai kills Zuko. It's like, oh, that's exactly what everyone thought it was, and it was very matter-of-factly stated in word for word.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, that's what happened in Zuko Alone. Zuko Alone accomplished that, what we saw in this, without directly saying it.
Yeah, we didn't need to know that her mother was a master herbalist and she can make a poison that's odorless, that just happens to be odorless and colorless.
Yeah,
and
we can just assume that the deal was Ursa had to kill Azulon or someone.
Spoilers, is actually the carbon monoxide.
In liquid form?
Yeah.
Yep.
Fancy.
I'm sure Britt would destroy that.
Britt's down here.
What was that, Jeff?
They'll just freeze you from the inside.
Yeah,
ooh.
That would be good.
Liquid nitrogen.
So I guess those were... We pretty much didn't talk about anything within the forest. Aang making faces, the bat has faces, there's lakes with the wolf visits. Do you care about any of this?
Nope.
Like, it's kind of cute, and it's really well drawn. Like, it shows off Guruhiru's art, like, all these spirits, and they're very awesomely drawn and stuff, but, like, who cares?
Seems like a Miyazaki thing.
Yeah, it's trying to be Miyazaki, but Miyazaki does this stuff and has a huge plot around it, and this is just, let's follow the bat.
Literally, he's following.
He just does that. Yeah, it's a significant portion of the second half, but it's, at least in my memory, dominated by the Ursa flashbacks, I guess. So at least he had substantial stuff, too, in there. Mel, you had some problems we maybe haven't mentioned yet. Do you want to... No. I have your chats copy and pasted if you want to see them.
I think I remember what I was saying. So yeah, the first one is Azula. A lot of questions there. Why does she not care, really not, like, kind of nonchalantly care that Zuko knows what the letter says? Why does Zuko not care that she knows he read it? Why does she not care what the letter says, period? Because she really makes no reference to it at all. Like, it's just completely Azula's motivations are really strange. Like, you kind of have this build-up when he first read the letter that Azula was hiding this letter from her brother, and she knew the truth, and then when it comes out and they both know that they know, she doesn't really care. Like, so,
even if there's good explanations for both of these things, which I think there maybe is for the second one, when I was reading all the stuff about the letter and the Azula and Zuko guys are just very confused. Like, it's not explained well, like, why they're doing these things. Or maybe he's relying upon us remembering stuff from part one, but we don't. I don't know. Okay. I think the Zuko explanation can be done by the stuff we talked about earlier of him wanting to figure it out. Like, okay, I'll go along with you, Azula, because I want to know myself. But they don't say that until later on, and you're very confused at first. And even when they do say it, it's not concrete. The stuff with Azula, I don't know her motivations. It's possible that he's like, oh, she's crazy for part of it, but why is she doing all stuff? Like, I don't know.
Did she have the letter in the first place if she clearly doesn't care? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I don't really get it. I don't think this is too significant of a flaw because he doesn't dwell on it, but it's just like, it's annoying.
Yeah.
What about the second one?
This one's a bigger one for me in turn. It's a complete plot hole as to why is Ozai just okay with keeping this kid who he knows or at least thinks is not his son around as his son and heir when we know he has plans to become Fire Lord? Like, why is he just so chill about that? I mean, he went and had or tried to have Ikea killed. He doesn't care that Zuko is not his son. He's willing to keep him around as his son when there's probably 10 different ways him as a prince could easily get rid of this kid without anyone having to know, and he wouldn't have to be embarrassed about it at all. So
the way the comic explains this is that he makes a deal with Ursa that he won't harm the children.
Well, it's even before that. He says...
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, he just does not care.
So, yeah, but even with the deal, I would say, and before it too, like when he doesn't have the deal, why does Ozai care? Like, it's not like he cares about honor. Ursa's gone, Ursa's banished, you have Zuko there. I'm not saying why doesn't he kill him, but why does he continue to accept Zuko's role in this? Now, a way to explain that is he's not sure if Zuko actually is his son or not. Maybe there's doubt, but that's never expressed in the comic. Yeah. Like, he's convinced that Zuko's not his son in the comic.
Yeah, weird stuff. Third one. Oh, I had a second one with Ozai, but it's small. It's just with the kids. When they're making the bargaining for the kids, he basically puts Azula in the same vein as Zuko, where I won't harm either of them, but that might just be in reaction to what Ursa said, because she initially brought up both of them, because she said, I take my children with me, and he's like, no, they'll stay here, and I won't harm them as long as you do your thing or whatever. So that just might be him making both of them collateral, but it was just weird for me. But the third one is what we talked about earlier, is just Ursa and the letter, and her reaction to Ozai finding out about the letter doesn't make sense. With the don't oh
yeah yeah
be the,
we talked about yeah we talked about this earlier.
So
yeah, that just it's just really. Like, I think, and like I said, I think he's trying to keep it ambiguous, but it's just, I don't know, doesn't really work. Any other, Jeff and Sam, any other things to add to these?
Nope.
Not surprising, Sam.
Sorry, I was reading.
Yeah, I have no idea how long this podcast is, but I assume we're pretty long. So,
Oh, yeah.
I guess, start to wrap it up. Overall, how would you... Did you like this more? Or I guess we already talked about that. Why would you rate it out of 10?
No.
And...
Don't make me do that.
Are you happy? Mel?
Out of 10? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to give this out of 10 just because, like, in terms of the search, it was good. Like, in terms of the two parts of the search, in terms of a storytelling comic book graphic novel, it was not good. So I guess in terms of just the search and the promise, I'd give it, like, a 7.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sam?
I don't know.
Not does not care out of 10.
Is that like a thing?
I guess.
I can give 2.5 stars out of 5.
Okay. Jeff?
Well, it's more memorable for me than part 1. I think one of the only things you need to know from part 1 is like the contents of that letter. That Azula found.
It also gives backstory to Ikem.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. So, I'd say also a 7.
7? Okay. Now that I think about it, I agree with Jeff that part 2 is more memorable than part 1, but I liked part 1 better from a... I loved all the Ursa flashbacks from a storytelling perspective. It was very good. I would give part 1 a 7-ish, like a 7 out of 10, as in solid / good. So this would probably be like a 6 or a 6.5. Like it's better than like a 5 being like average. Like the promise is on the 3 to 5.5 scale. And the search, I think, is significantly better. It's like 6 to 7-ish.
What about that May comics that happened?
I don't even know.
I remember reading it. I don't remember what happened.
It was like there's the secret fanfic underground Ozai movement.
Yeah.
And that was the
thing. It's like, oh, this happens in every single post Avatar fanfic ever.
I mean, and it's only natural.
We find out that Mei still loves Zuko.
Yeah.
We knew that.
I still have my rankings for Zuko ships? No. I'd like to share that.
Changed them 5 times.
Yeah, well, I have the official Zuko ships ranking. The best Zuko ship is Zukang. The second best Zuko ship is Toko, Toph and Zuko. I still think that actually could happen in Korra. We'll see. The third best Zuko ship is Zeus. 4 is Kiko, which is the ship I made up of. I keep forgetting her name. Is Kiyi and Zuko, assuming that. They're not. I mean, it could be Zeus and Kiko and time skip. You know, like all the socially unacceptable stuff, like into one ship. Let's do that. 5 is Mako. I do like Mako, but I like the
you like it by default.
Kind of. I think the more they don't wrap it up, the more I dislike it. Like I liked it a lot, like in the headbands and stuff like
I like how the end where she shows up and she's like, "Don't break up with me again," is completely thrown out the window.
Yeah.
In the promise.
Right. You can't just wrap it up in the newspaper and call it a day. You gotta like go to like classes for that. You know, present wrapping classes and stuff. They have
you want
those,
them
right?
to go to present classing wrapping.
Present wrapping classes.
It's pretty late. And then,
wait, Dylan, can I don't care out of 10 actually be a legitimate score?
Yes.
From now on.
No, don't use it for
you've
core
opened
episodes.
The floodgates.
Don't do that.
Using it for
present wrapping comics. Classes.
And then to continue finish my Zuko ships, then the dot dot dot, the 10,000th best Zuko ship is Zuki, because it sucks. Zuko and Zuki. Second the worst. And the worst one, 10,001, is Zutara. Because it all will forever be the worst Zuko ship.
The worst ship.
No, these are official according to
the... These are the official Zuko ship rankings.
That has everyone, literally everyone been accepts. 5 years since the finale aired.
Everyone accepts these rankings, even though much. One of them is a ship I made up. So, yay.
Who cares anymore?
It's just that awkward scene in The Awakening.
Zeus is legit. I mean, if you interpret a scene in Promise Part 2 completely wrong, you can find Zeus, okay?
You mean...
That's my hidden Zeus for this.
Well, no,
episode.
It was that creepy scene in The Awakening.
Oh, no. Yeah, that too. That's a legit canon scene.
That's I don't. They definitely didn't intend for that, but.
No, know. I think they did. I don't know.
Let's have him show up in his sister's room in the middle of the night.
We interview.
He won't bother to get dressed.
First question they ask: did you intend Zeus-est in The Awakening? That's my number one.
Because that's what 90% of us got out of it.
Okay, let's wrap this up. It's 2:43 a.m.
Is it? Oh, wow.
I know,
Sam
right?
has no concept of time. Because it's late for now. She doesn't sleep ever, no. And then she gets sad.
Sam was watching Orange Is the New Black.
It was very good. It's not for children at all.
Yeah, not for children. But we talked about Game of Thrones, so you know, whatever.
Well, sort of.
This is I don't know. It's
pretty inappropriate.
Yes,
it's on Netflix.
But it's
I don't think
good.
You could argue.
Like
oh, is that the that's that show?
Yeah,
that's. The,
Anyway.
I was like, that sounds familiar, but I don't know why, but I got
it's
it
show
I didn't
watching.
Put it, because I was just thinking jail show.
Anyway, I've been your main host, Dylan. Co-hosts have been Jeff, Mel, and Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Technical director, AJ, Kevin, Jeff. Jeff noticed I had you to technical director. I don't know what that, yeah. That, the credit
Kevin
that doesn't mean anything.
Why does Kevin and everybody else still get it?
I don't know why I gave Kevin that credit. Just
because
so he
he's famous now and we have to claim him.
No, he did significantly contribute the direction of the podcast, which is, I guess,
why. He's not here anymore.
No.
Yes, Sam.
AJ.
Sam, were you even around when he was here?
Nope.
That was before all their times except Mel. Musical remixes by Luke Tripp. All additional music credits to Jeremy Zuckerman and the Yoshida brothers. And I edit, produce the podcast. Thanks, a big thanks to Jeff for getting the songs to play in the background. That will save me a lot of trouble. Yeah.
Hard work. Are you allergic to work, Dylan?
Podcast editing, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, anyway.
Pass along to somebody else.
Do you curse? I didn't even...
Yes, you
no.
did.
Yeah, you did.
No, she definitely
no, I didn't.
Said...
No, I said you should...
You said the thing.
You said...
What did I say?
I don't want to say it because I don't want two edits.
I didn't say anything.
I think that was actually our only edit. Whatever. It's at the very end, so.
I didn't say anything.
I'm sorry, Sam.
No, I'm pretty sure.
Did
you
I say something?
I've been
you did. You
I'm
definitely
just
did.
I'm just going to silence it and keep all this in.
It's orange.
Thanks for listening, guys. Friday is our Comic-Con podcast. Big deal. Everyone get psyched. Follow us on Tumblr for the thing. If you... Okay. Send me an email or tweet or post in the forum saying I listened until the end. Keyword. What should be the keyword?
Whatever we end on.
Secret word is natural walnuts and almonds because I have a package of that here. So if
no, that's too long.
Actually,
make it one word.
Almonds, okay? Almonds. If you listened until the end, message us almonds because I'm very convinced that no one's listening until the end of these podcasts. Also, no one's listening in general, which is really annoying.
Oh, Dylan, stop being such a...
Only 300 people listened to our last podcast.
Oh,
that's ridiculous.
It's about commentary, you dummy.
Yeah, Dylan, we were commentating on commentary.
That's the most exciting
Daily
thing to me.
Daily Grace can only do that.
That was meta, man.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, anyway, what should we end on?
Wait, what did you say? Like, are they going to get a reward if they...
No, they get my credit.
No,
we'll read off everyone emails in.
Yeah, we'll read off the next podcast.
Yeah. By the way, people have been emailing us. I'm not gonna. I'll read your emails eventually. One of you said, "Respond to me. Don't read this on the podcast." I'm like, "What? Come on!" Like,
naturally, we need to.
Like, I'm gonna read it on the podcast now. Don't say that. Like, if you email us, it's meant to be read on the podcast. Okay. If you want me to respond, tweet at us. There's the new rule. Okay. Anything better than walnuts to end on? Even though the keyword
I
is
said almonds.
That would confuse people. The keyword's nice. Almonds that we'd end on walnuts.
They're gonna say walnuts.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's
Jeff
see if that,
is Jeff
let's
is,
see if we trick anyone. Okay.
Wait, what's the line from Batman? Some men just wanna watch the world burn. It's Jeff.
Exactly.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning.
One, thanks guys for listening. 1, 2, 3, walnuts.
Walnuts are in the world.
Hell, say walnuts.
Ah, walnuts.